All right, welcome, welcome to another episode of the Creditor Podcast. I'm your host, Chase Palmieri, and with me today is Jack Fawn. Jack is a serial entrepreneur with over 20 years experience building and scaling startups, multiple of which were actually acquired. He held previous roles with Digital Trends and Money Crashers, and he is currently very busy as the Chief Marketing Officer at AirDeck and the Chief Technology Officer at Aegist. And on top of that, if that weren't enough, he runs an agency called FanZoo that works with local news publishers to monetize their digital properties. Jack, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Chase. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I want to talk a lot today about the struggles facing these publishers. You work in many different roles. You have worked in many different roles with these publishers, but the environment in small news outlet, newspaper publishing today is very different than it was even just 10 years ago. So I want to start with what you're doing at FanZoo to help these publishers monetize. So first off, how many publishers does FanZoo work with?
So we work with publishers that are part of the AAN, which is the Association of Alternative News. There are 115 publishers altogether in that association. And we work with different publishers in all forms and factors, from SEO to content management systems to advertising as well.
Okay. And what is the primary way that these publishers are able to drive traffic to their digital sites? Because we know that a lot of them have been forced to try to leverage social media lately, but I know that SEO is also a great strategy for the ones that are being a little more clever. How are they driving traffic, the best of the best?
Yeah, the best of the best right now within those publishers are driving traffic mainly through newsletters and their social media. You know, those that are actually being able to develop an SEO strategy around their content, both technically and content strategy, has started to see more diversity amongst their traffic sources. So right now, it's still the local news presence is dependent on kind of the fans and then the people who within the local community. And, you know, they can do that through newsletters. They can do that through the social media outreach. And if you can add on SEO and other areas, you're golden. So
is it different to try to monetize your content as a local publisher as opposed to like a national or international publisher? Because maybe you can partner with local businesses somehow. Are there different strategies that these local publishers can take advantage of?
Yeah, so local publishers, you know, a lot of these are traditionally newspaper publishers that run, you know, weekly or daily or monthly printed papers. And their source of revenues in the past have been through classified ads or, you know, local shops and sponsorships within those newspapers. The challenges there are, you know, once you go digital, not all the local publishers or not all the local merchants have the ability to provide an online presence or have the marketing dollars to work with these publishers. So the national newspapers obviously have a bigger advantage because they can reach a national audience or they have advertisers that look at the numbers that they're getting from a national scale and want to spend money there. But local publishers, it's a challenge. You know, selling locally with, you know, mom and pop shops in the local area, that's always going to be a challenge. And especially because they just don't have the budgets as some of these large media companies do.
And does FanZoo try to help these publishers diversify their revenue streams? For example, you like to maybe see them have some subscription revenue, some maybe referral or affiliate marketing type revenue. What are the types of revenue streams that you think are even an option for these types of publishers these days?
Yeah, so you know, I spent my time over Digital Trends, and one of the advantages we had there were a global publication. And because we were so big, you had people coming to us saying, hey, here's a product, you know, we'll pay you to advertise this product. We'll pay you to write about this product with partnerships and sponsorships, as well as, you know, full page takeovers during launches. There's a lot of resources that are available, but they always target the larger national or global publishers. These local publishers have a much more challenging time. And so display advertising, affiliate marketing, these are things that you have to be somewhat sophisticated or invest a lot of dollars in order to be really successful. So where FanZoo came in is we partnered with a couple ad ops, ad agencies that have the demand, the publishers from a larger scale. But by pulling these publishers together and saying, hey, we have 115 publishers that are part of this network. They, our reach, you know, they may be a couple hundred thousand here, you know, 50,000 there or a million there. Combined, you have a reach now of 50, 60 million monthly visitors. So when you have that size and that type of number, then you can attract more merchants and advertisers. So what FansViews tries to do is to represent these publishers to the national brands on a programmatic level, at least to say, you know, these are the publishers that are available, and you should spend your, you know, your programmatic dollars in getting your message out through these local publishers. So display advertising is one. Sponsoring content, I think, is where the most success can have from a local perspective. If you're a, you know, Tammy's yard shop down in Portland, Oregon, you may take that and say, hey, I want to advertise locally only because it's a walk-in shop or online shop. Most of that is achieved through sponsorships or newsletter inclusion. Those are ways that you can monetize there. And then through affiliate linking. If you have products that you want to sell, providing an affiliate link for the publisher so they can, you know, include your product in a listicle in different roundups, and then they get paid. It's a win-win situation for both sides.
Yeah. So from what you just said, it sounds like FansView represents kind of the B2B outreach, direct outreach to the people who are looking to actually promote content, promote some advertising space, and you represent them by kind of packaging up all of your different publisher partners as an aggregate and say, look, we actually have a lot of different traffic and attention that we can get for your content here. And you, I guess, would, on their behalf, you would help drive certain advertisements to certain publishers. How does it work if an advertising company says, okay, we've got these ads at this price, here you go. Do you decide how to make sure that those get proportionately on all of your different publisher sites?
Sure. So, you know, there's a couple things that go into it. And, you know, if you go down to it, a lot of it has to do with the platforms that these larger advertisers are bidding on. So there's a bidding process, right? They go into these platforms and say, I want to bid, you know, a price per 1,000 impressions, and I want to target these type of publishers. And usually within that queue, you have a process that kind of eliminates the weaker publishers and the more targeted publishers that the advertiser is trying to reach. What FansView does is works with these publications to, one, improve their technical setup to make sure that, hey, they're a properly vetted site that's set up properly to display ads with high viewability rates, with strong conversion rates, and a good quality set that's not spammy and displays, you know, random things that shouldn't be there. Once that happens, then we help increase the score of that site, basically how they appear within these different bidding software that advertisers use with demand partners out there to, you know, put their price in. So once that happens, once we are able to turn this publisher into a more rich type of publisher, the advertisers then, when they put in their bids, they get these sites are included in that process so that, you know, they're included in the bidding, and whatever price they put in is evaluated with other advertisers that may be trying to advertise on that site as well.
And that makes a lot of sense because a lot of these publishers, they don't necessarily have tech backgrounds or startup backgrounds. They don't necessarily know how all these technical pieces fit together. And so there's a clear mutually beneficial relationship to working with FansView. But when these publishers come to you, is that their biggest problem with monetizing content, is the fact that they don't know how to represent themselves in these kinds of bidding marketplaces or how to plug into them?
That's a big component of it. I think, you know, the products and services that come to these local publishers or what's available to them, most services and providers will look at them and say, oh, you're too small. You're not set up right. And they care about just the advertising dollars. So it's like, if you get your site all fixed up and cleaned up, get higher viewability rates and put the ads in the right spots, then we'll work with you guys, right? But most of the times, because these publishers are small, they've got, you know, small budgets, and they aren't able to create and do all these things in the back end to make that happen, it's a challenge for them. And then most of the time they don't know where to look. And so they'll do their local ads, or they'll plug in something manually and they'll say, okay, we're going to run something with the local ice cream shop and get those in there. Or, you know, on the local side, we're publishing this music festival, and we have advertisers there. We'll just use those advertisers and put them into the website. It's kind of bundled together in terms of pricing, but they're missing out on a huge opportunity from traffic that just comes organically through search and other means, where advertisers are looking for the local newspaper presence, but you have to be set up properly. So these papers just aren't set up, and it's a challenge for them to do that.
Yeah, and I'd imagine that there's a lot of idealism in a lot of these publishers that come and contact you for work. Do you have to convince some of them that they need to actually do advertising on their site? Is there pushback to do things like a promoted banner on their sites?
No, that's the neat part about these newspaper publishers is they understand that advertising is a big part of the media game. It has to be a part of their strategy, whether it be print or online. And so advertising is a big component of how they survive, how journalism needs to continue to thrive in the environment we are, is these publishers have to generate income, generate revenue. And if you're online, you have to generate advertising revenue. So yeah, you can plug in your Google AdSense and get some couple pennies here and there. Willamette Week plugged in that and they were generating, good $400 or $500 a month through AdSense. Where we came in with Willamette Week, for example, I looked at their system, cleaned up the way that they were presenting the ads on the site, did an overhaul of some of their SEO and technical requirements on the back end, and now they're cruising, doing anywhere from 10 to 12, 13,000 a month in through demand partners that are coming through and bidding on their site. And then whenever AdSense pops in, if they run out of inventory, that's where some of those things will happen. But the reality is, what we try to do is make it their site, available within the exchange so that the dollars will reach them.
Okay. And we're talking about how these publishers, if they were to try to reach out directly to these advertisers, that in many cases, they don't have the reach, the viewership to necessarily land a deal with these marketers, and you represent them in aggregate, and that helps get some of these deals closed. Do you ever have publishers that try to engage your services, but you think they're too small to be part of your club?
Yeah, no, and that's a challenge as well. So we do have publishers who are, new, they're coming up, or they just have a small footprint. They're in a small town in, on the coast out in North Carolina, for example. And it's small. They have a good and highly engaged audience for the ones that are there, but they're, maybe have 25, 30,000 visitors a month to their site. That's going to be a little too small. So with those, what we try to do is, sponsorships and affiliate and more branded deals or inclusion deals are going to be more beneficial for them because, they can partner with a local winery or something and, do an ad and sponsor the site. That's going to make them a better result for their advertising efforts than trying to get programmatic advertisers to come in and get 20,000 page views for their ads. It's just not enough for the large advertisers.
Yeah, that's actually what I was going to ask next. So I might ask you to reiterate that in more detail. So if a publisher wants to advertise, but the advertisers say, no, you don't have the reach, there are other ways that they can monetize, some of which you just mentioned. How would you recommend a small publisher who's not quite at the level that they need to get advertisements on their site, how would you recommend that they monetize their platform in the meantime?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. What brands love, what merchants love is to be seen, right? And if you are a smaller publisher and you're able to give them that brand presence on your site, there are multiple ways to do that, whether you're creating specific content, advertorial content, sponsored content, or just giving them placements on your site where you know the views are coming. What that does is it builds a relationship with those advertisers. The goal is obviously for the merchants to get results, right? If they're selling organic foods or whatnot, they want to be able to see the results of that. But the nice part is, they're not paying, may not be paying directly for that. They're paying for the exposure. So you can measure through the period of time that they're running campaign with you. But I would say advertorials, basically something that they can write and you can publish on your site, or a sponsor, sponsored content where you can write something and talk about their product, and they pay you for those, and the longevity of how long that exists on the site. Newsletter inclusions. A lot of these smaller publishers have strong newsletter lists because they can have 5, 10, 15, 20,000 email subscribers. That is actually very, very valuable, because if you have a good open rate with your newsletters, which a lot of these folks do, you can talk about the stories that are impacting the local area that they're at, but you include a product from, Sally's organic, fruits. All of a sudden it adds a lot of value to that vendor, and they're willing to pay, whether it be, $500,000, $2,500 a month, that's real revenue that they can be generating.
Yeah. And we hear a lot that this, the idea that local news is dying or is on its way to being dead. And obviously you're working very closely with a lot of these smaller local publishers. Do you agree to a certain extent that this is happening, that these publishers are hurting and in many cases dying and going away? Or do you think that it was a matter of them having to kind of reinvent themselves and that now we're going to see a resurgence in local news?
Yeah, a lot of the local news publishers, they've definitely have struggled, especially because of how they haven't figured out what's needed in order to reinvent themselves. And so that's where we typically come in, is to help them identify where they're at. And yeah, if they're running in the red, that's one thing. But if you, have certain things you can try to figure out to grow and generate revenue, that's another thing. So yes, a lot of publishers have died. They grew too fast or trying to replicate some of the national brands, but they're really a local type of publisher. They're going to have challenges, and the cost is going to, overrun who they are. Local publishers thrive when they're able to, one, create really great journalism, which I love local journalism. That's, again, one of my main things, is local journalism is very impactful for the community that you're in and the impact it has on charities and events and people who live in that community. So that content is very, very important, but they have to survive. And the ones that are transforming, the ones that are figuring things out, they're thriving now. They're doing well. The Willamette Weeks of the world in Portland, they're doing phenomenally well. But they have their own struggles as well. Some of these other publishers are, deciding whether they can maintain what they're doing, maintain the cost of trying to survive in this economy and generate revenue just to cover their expenses, right? So that's the challenge. And so a lot of companies will try to offer services to these publishers, but they charge a fee that they would charge a national publisher, and they just don't have the budgets to handle that. So my goal has always been from the beginning, ensure journalism survives, ensure these local publishers survive. And if they're not doing well, I'm not doing well. And so we have it set up in a way where there's no cost to do these things. A lot of it has to do with, let's help you generate more revenue. We'll do it on a rev share. So if you're succeeding, we're succeeding. And this is a win-win for both sides.
Yeah. So it makes a lot of sense to kind of aggregate these players together when going out to seek more ways to monetize their platforms. Do you ever think about grouping them together when going to AWS, for example, and saying, hey, I'd like to get a lower rate across the server costs for all of these different outlets because I have them all bundled up together, or maybe some other types of services where you try to bundle them for cost savings?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of opportunity there. I think the challenge is kind of organizing, the herd, right? Getting the herd all come together. The advertising side is easy because it's a domain and they exist separately. They have their own ad management account. And it's just a matter of, fine tuning some of these things and including in them into kind of this group. But there's PMP, private marketplace, for example. But when it comes to like hosting and other services, hosting may not be the best example. We probably could go to some of these services and say, hey, we've got these publishers. Give us a deal so we can get them transformed and moved over. But that's a big challenge because these publishers work very independently. They're still trying to figure a lot of things out, and they've got, in some cases, and I'm not joking, you have, oh, my wife's brother, put together their site. He just, graduated college and had nothing to do. So he built the site, and now no one's really managing it. It's sitting on some cheap, domain that's shared with you know, 10 other publishers, right? That's the challenge that they're facing. So to say, okay, well, let's migrate you over to a more robust system, you know, and whatnot, suddenly dollar figures pop into their eyes and the bandwidth that they have to be able to do that is a challenge. So I'm not going to say it's easy. We have tried in some cases to provide certain discounts and deals that are bundled for those publishers. But in most cases, it's a one-by-one situation.
Okay. And obviously monetizing your website is the best way to drive these businesses forward and make sure that they're, you know, have sustainable operations going forward and that they're not going to disappear on us. But what other big problems do you think are facing local publishers or just even smaller independent publishers more generally?
Yeah, I think the fight for relevance in news is one of their biggest challenges right now, right? When you have national media talking about Portland, and that tends to be what's happening, what you see on Twitter or you see on social media or you see what gets picked up, the fight for national for local and national attention is a big challenge. You know, where I think what's happening is some of these publishers stay too local, so you know it's you're out of the relevance to some extent. I think some of the challenges that these local publishers face is wrapped up around trying to do too much or not doing enough, right? And you have to find your sweet spot. A lot of these publishers, once you find your sweet spot, this is a journalism that we're going to write about. This is our reach on social media. Let's make sure we engage with our readership in multiple different ways. And once you have that engagement, you'll start to gather feedback from people. You know, Willamette Week has done a great job of just hearing from the audience, from their followers and their readership. And the reader says, we don't like seeing this. Well, they've made some adjustments. Can you provide this in a more easy to read or listen form? We've provided solutions for that. So, you know, if you can adjust to the environment you're in, listen to your readership, those are going to be things that are going to help you in the long run. And if you try too hard to be like the national, you're gonna fail. If you're not trying hard enough, obviously that's a failure in itself. So you have to find your sweet spot in there.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the different aspects of these media properties that you think are gotta-haves in 2021. Obviously a newsletter where you have that direct email list with your readers and you can re-engage them when you have new stories or announcements. That seems like a no-brainer. And very cost efficient for those media properties to manage. I would argue that a podcast might be really useful too, especially at the local level where you can actually interview local administrations or local business owners, that kind of thing. I want to get your take on that. But what other aspects do you think these companies need to tag on to their existing website? Do you think that each should have their own iOS and Android app, for example? What do you think needs to be the must-have add-ons in 2021?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that we've seen a lot of success with in multiple places are push notifications, right? Being able to get these alerts and news out to your readership, whether they be through mobile or through desktop. And the challenges of mobile, obviously, is you have to have an app in order to do that. Unless you're on Android, some of the push notifications will work on Chrome. But building an app and maintaining it is a challenge. There are some quick and easy solutions out there, as well as some things have been in development, aggregating different news sources while still providing the push notification feature. But those are there are challenges in those as well. Content marketing is a big part of journalism and publishing, right? You have to be able to market your content and reach people, whether it be newsletters, social media, push notifications, or other means, right? And so for me, I think, you know, podcasting, like you mentioned before, that's a great way to engage with your readership and then provide content that people can engage in different ways. You know, being able to do push notifications is pretty critical because you can kind of see real quickly the news that is relevant and how people are, you know, responding to the different things that are happening. At a time last year during the pandemic and the elections and crises that were happening, it was a great source of traffic for a lot of these publishers to be able to push out a notification, even if it was desktop. It was a great driver of traffic. So I would say yes, you need to look at, you know, newsletters. You need to be, you know, be able to engage, whether it be a podcast or a you know, live chat on Instagram, for example, or Facebook or other social media. But then push notifications is a great way to just get that content out to the people in mass.
It sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like maybe you're saying that these larger national or international media properties can maybe get away with less advertising and sustain their operations through subscription revenue because they have these big name brands, and so they can drive greater subscription revenue. But it sounds like maybe local publishers, it's just not enough to try to drive subscription, also because we know that news consumers aren't willing to pay for, I don't know what the number is right now, but they're probably not willing to pay for more than three or four news subscriptions at a time. And those probably, majority of them probably go to things like the Financial Times and Washington Post and New York Times. So do you encourage the local publishers to try to go into subscriptions, or you try to teach them, hey, look, you're not the New York Times. We need to find something that you guys can be better at?
Yeah, that is a great question, because I have a couple of publishers that are on subscription. They're doing it pretty well, right? They offer readership the ability to read, you know, one, two, I think maybe even three articles before they get into a being subscribed, before they can read more. One of the things that we found, we have a publisher, and I keep going back to Willamette Week just because they're close here in Portland. I know their founder very well. One of the things they started doing was to just ask the readership and say, you know, we want to keep journalism going strong. They're very authentic with their message. And so, you know, we, to keep journalism and the work that we do, keep our voice out in the local media, we're open to donations, and whether it be monthly recurring donations or one-time donations. And we appreciate that. Amazingly, they were able to sign up, I mean, thousands and thousands of dollars in readership in monthly recurring revenue as well. People are very, very, you know, if you built a good relationship, they're very, very happy to help keep their source of news that they enjoy alive, right? And, you know, for a lot of publishers out there, if you built that connection already, rather than doing a subscription service, you can ask for a monthly donation or some sort of recurring donation as a way to keep things going. And if maybe $5 a month, right? Or maybe $25 a month, you'd be surprised how many people are willing to say, yeah, I'll do it because I love reading the contents here and I want to make sure that they survive as well. And you build that connection with that local, in that local presence. And that's another great way to do that. I do have that a couple publishers that do subscription, and, you know, but they do it still in addition with advertising. So it's, they take the same approach as far as messaging goes. But again, people are willing to put that out there. So I wouldn't say that, pushing the subscription model like a New York Times or something like that is something that you have to do or something you have to stray away from, but figure out what your audience responds to. And more often than not, they will respond to kind of an approachable way of messaging them and saying, you know, help us continue to do what we do to make sure that you have the most accurate and reliable source of news locally.
Right. And you're very aware of what we do at Credder. So I'm not trying to lead you with this next question. But what is it about these publishers? What are they trying to do to help build trust with their audiences? Because we know that trust in media more broadly is at an all-time low. I'm not exactly sure whether that's more in reference to these larger national brands and cable news, but in general, trust in media is not doing well. Do you see any initiatives, or do you recommend any initiatives for your publishers on how they can help establish rapport with their readers?
Yeah, that's a great question, obviously. And I think the work that you're doing over at Credders is super important in trying to raise that level of quality and trust in publishers. I think making sure that your writers and the people whose bylines are on the articles on your site are reputable people. Their personal brand is important. They're journalists, right? Let's make sure that those people are representing your brand and your newspaper in a positive way, and working with your editorial team so that they can push out that content and or be proud of the work that they do. trust is a big factor. And if they're in the community, especially local publishers, a guy like Aaron Mesh here in Portland is continually interacting with people on Twitter and other social media methods to engage on certain topics. He's talking about random things that affect the local community, but he's also writing content and writing articles that suddenly people recognize his name and his presence as it relates to the publisher. Trust is a big factor. So how do you gain that trust? And I think there's, some publisher just pops up in the middle of the night and starts writing random content, and the content is, doesn't have a real name to it, or you can't go and follow and find who the author is and the other works they've done. You lose that, that trust factor. Now I do that myself because I always want to research and see who's actually writing these articles, right? But not everybody does that, and so you need to have some form of tools and that allow you to, I hate using the term police it, but you want to be able to get the credibility of the content that's being written. And if you're a local publisher that's built a reputation for putting out good content, great content, that's one thing. But if you're an up and coming publisher, you have to build some of that trust. And so there are different ways. I think Creditors, what you're doing there is phenomenally important in helping to get people to put their stamp of approval that this is good. This is quality content. This is, real content. It's not just made up news for clickbait and trying to get people to view your content. So I think those are all things that are going to be super important. And the work that you do is going to be very, very relevant for future publishers.
Thank you. And I'm guessing as a marketer that you're familiar with Gary Vaynerchuk.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So
absolutely.
So Gary often tells business operators that they should be very active on these emerging social media type platforms. He's speaking a lot these last few weeks about Clubhouse, for example. And before that, he was early on TikTok and early on Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and Instagram. And he believes in these business operators being early on these platforms. I'm wondering if you encourage your publishers to have some kind of an active social media presence on all of these platforms, or if you encourage them to kind of limit it to Facebook and Twitter, or how you think about that. Because yes, any of these platforms or any of these publishers can probably hire some college student to handle their social media. They might not necessarily do it well, but they could probably get some level of presence on a lot of these different platforms. Which ones do you think are the gotta haves? They gotta be present on these platforms.
Yeah, if you're a news publisher, by all means, you have to be on Twitter in some form or factor. I mean, I think Twitter is a big source of news now, both good and bad, right? You mentioned Birdwatch the other day to me, and I got an invite, and so I'm actually a Birdwatch watchdog, I guess, in that case, but. Bird watcher. Yeah, exactly. But I think Twitter is one. Facebook, is still dying in a sense of the activity and in the news and the media. You'll hear about what's factual, what's not, and how that platform has turned away a lot of different people, but it's still very relevant in the content that you're pushing out. Now the different ways that you're pushing it out is what's important, because if you have a Facebook page, for example, it's just, people aren't really going to those places to look for your content anymore. And people want to be able to share engaging things. When it comes to new platforms, like Clubhouse and whatnot, I'm just like Gary in the sense where I love to explore new things as they come out. And part of that's an understanding, and not everything, that I sign up for is going to turn out to be a great product, but understanding how those products came about and kind of their premise can lead you to kind of see the different opportunities that may be out there for future products and solutions, right? I would recommend to publishers and especially journalists and writers to stay number one on top of the ones that matter most right now, in the sense of verification badges on Twitter and Facebook. Like, use those platforms, get verified. Your media, you can actually get verified through the media news outlets, and use those platforms in a way that continues to provide real news and accurate news. the new platforms are great ways to have conversations. Clubhouse is a great place to go and, you know, join these conversations with others or start a room and create your own conversations around certain topics that I think there's missing in the local news right now. There's a lot of stuff around certain, you know, CPG or direct to consumer or other types of topics. But local things are affecting your local. Get involved in those conversations and then figure out what's new, what's happening. But I would say stay focused on what you know works and how you best engage with your audience.
Okay. And last question on kind of the FanZoo side of things and the publishers you're working with. What about comment sections? We've seen from the larger national publishers that a lot of the comment sections are starting to disappear. I'd imagine that on the local level, maybe the comment sections are even more valuable to have. How do you deal with the publishers as far as encouraging them to have some kind of reader feedback?
That's a great question. And that trend has been happening for a while as far as the larger publishers removing comments altogether, because they're a big trap for spam and you know, arguments, you know, other things, debates that happen on there. And it can get really cluttered and messy, and it takes away from the content that's there. On the local news side, though, however, it's a great engagement tool. It's a great way to insert yourself into that conversation as a writer or as a publication to answer people and provide feedback. You know, moderating those comments is definitely a challenge. I'm a big proponent of still using comments in the right environment. Now, those conversations a lot of time will say, hey, it's carried over to Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or whatnot. That's fine. But if you have an ability to engage with your audience right there on the content, I still think it's still valuable. I think it can be a huge distraction for some of these larger publishers, and I get that, and they can, you know, simply remove it. For local publishers, I see a lot of you know, people recognize other people and names because they're in the same community, and they're like, oh, you know, Fred from, you know, this company such and such is commenting here. I'm going to go reply to him, and you know, it feel more like a family. I think, like, especially local publishers, you feel close-knit and you pretty much know people in the area and who they are. So,
yeah, I 100% agree. I think there's more upside for these smaller local publishers. And I agree. I'll bet people are a little more polite in the local news comment sections because you never know who you're going to walk across the street next. Let's turn now to what you're doing at Aegis. You helped found this publisher, which has kind of a very new and interesting target demographic. Why don't you tell listeners a little bit about what Aegis is?
Yeah, so Aegis started by David Stewart, who was a photographer. He's capturing images of people doing amazing things. And as he, you know, grew older and you know, got into his 50s and now he's 60, he started to see that, you know, a lot of the ways that, you know, being old, it was represented in both agency news, in content advertising. And he's like, wait a minute, I'm 50 and that, everything I'm seeing out there, that's not who I am, right? And so he said, well, I want to share what I'm doing. I want to share what these amazing people that are my friends and my colleagues, what they're doing. So he started to create this newsletter, and we eventually turned it into a media site now with amazing stories, inspiration of people doing amazing things, 50 plus, right? You have people starting companies. You have today, we have a 74-year-old Joanne who is, you know, training, teaching people how to train. She's, if you look at her profile, she's now buff and strong in her 70s, right? And these are the people that you want to be inspired by, that are aspirational, attainable, so that you're not, as you're aging, it can be a huge topic, mental health issue where people are like, I'm worthless. I'm, you know, where, people view me in a certain way. Every time I look at advertising, I see what I'm supposed to look like, and people will go towards that. What we're trying to do at Aegis is to take that away and say, you know what, this is actually what people are doing. They're traveling. They're doing so many more things. They're starting companies. They're out there inspiring other people. And so we can bring those stories to life. It creates an audience that feels more excited about what's so much life left to live, right? And from an advertising perspective, that's great for brands. Brands need to understand how to market properly so that they can grab the attention of this audience. You know, you see everything today is around millennials and Gen Z. Well, the reality is this generation that sometimes is forgotten controls pretty much 70% of the wealth, you know, in the United States. So, you know, if you want to target those, the right advertisers, or you, those advertisers want to target the right audience, that's the audience that you should be targeting. And so, but you have to target in the right way. You know, people in wheelchairs and medical alerts and pharmaceuticals is not the way to represent that demographic. You know, they're driving nice cars, Land Rovers, traveling, you know, climbing, hiking, exercising, running marathons in their 50s and 60s and 70s, right? So the Ageless mission is to continue to share these stories, provide inspiration for a lot of people, and help those who are going into their 50s to see hope in a different light.
Yeah. And in the tech industry, we often refer to the grandma test, where you want to make sure that your product or your service, you could put it in front of your grandma and she would understand how to use it and could get through it without any confusion, and make sure they could get from the beginning to the end of whatever the steps are in that process. As the chief technology officer at Ageless, do you have to think slightly differently about, you know, how big a button is, or the font size, or are there any aspects of that, or maybe how the content reaches your readers in the first place? Is there any extra kind of tricks or like padding that you've set up to kind of nerf the readership?
Yeah, no, this is a great question. I have to be cognizant. You know, it's funny. I have perfect vision, actually better than perfect vision in 2015. But now that I'm in my 40s, the rate at which it transitions from near and far is getting weaker, in the sense I still have great vision once it transitions, but the transition doesn't happen fast enough, right? And so where I'm going with this is, I have to be cognizant of people as they age. There are certain limitations that they have. So font sizes, as if you notice on Ageless, will be a little bit bigger than most places that you go, and that's just because it's a, you know, making it a little bit easier for people. But yes, spacing is important, and making it easy for people to navigate, because yes, the it's still, you know, a lot of things where they're not millennials or Gen Zers who can just scroll through things, flip through things, have a short attention span. They like to engage in this type of content, and giving them the tools to be able to do that in a way that is convenient to them is something that's super important, and how we present the content, how we lay out the website and everything.
Yeah, and you were mentioning how on Ageless, it's a lot of storytelling from these people in these older communities. Was there a lot of coronavirus relevant sharing of stories, a lot of kind of telling the tales of dangerous situations that some of these people might have been put through?
Absolutely. I think, you know, trying to share that information and knowledge to a, you know, a generation that was at high risk potentially, right? And so, you know, we wrote a lot of good content around, you know, things to do to, you know, stay healthy, things to do to, you know, give yourself a lower risk of contracting the virus and stay healthy overall, because, you know, some of the challenge, you can still contract COVID, but, you know, it depends a lot on how your body is and the health that you're in order to fight that virus. And, you know, so we provided a lot of that content. We shared stories. We, you know, had exercise, yoga, instructions, and then different podcasts to talk about understanding how the virus affects people and the things you can do to take precaution for it.
Okay. And before we get to some of these last questions that I ask every guest, and before we get to where people should go to follow your work, why don't you look at the camera and tell these smaller publishers exactly like the top three or four things that they need to be focused on, the things that matter the most?
Yeah, when it comes to being a publisher, there are really a few things that really matter the most when it comes to how your content is seen. Technology plays a big factor into that. So, you know, make sure that you're on a good CMS that can get your content out there with less distractions. Make sure that you're set up properly so that Google and Bing and Yahoo and other search engines can actually read your content from a bot perspective, right? And get rid of some of the distractions. You think that throwing more ads onto your site will make more money is absolutely not true. Getting the right ads in the right places, and sometimes fewer is actually better, to have a stronger impact for those advertisers will make a big difference in both your user experience as well as the advertisers that may want to advertise on your site.
Okay. And why don't you give listeners where they should go to follow your work?
So I'm on Twitter most of the time. You can follow me at Jack Fan. You can find my agency at fanzoo.com. And yeah, that's where I'm mostly at. You can find me on Instagram or anywhere else as well. But a lot of what I try to do is to share that knowledge and help out as many people as I can with the knowledge that I've gained. So.
Great. And the last two questions for you here that I ask every guest that comes on the podcast. Number one is Bitcoin. Are you a believer or not so much?
I am a believer. I've invested in some cryptos as well as Bitcoin. I've done some mining as well. I think the idea of cryptocurrency as a currency has changed and shifted into more of a commodity and a tool that people are using in investing. I still believe in a currency that is over digital makes the most sense and finding out where that is, but we're not quite there yet. It's making that kind of a mainstream. But from an investment standpoint, it's kind of fun to see some of the exciting things that are happening around different cryptos.
Do you ever talk to your publishers about Bitcoin, about whether they should have some of their treasury assets in Bitcoin, maybe like 1%, anything like that?
I have not. I have not. I know that a lot of it is a learning curve. And so, trying to get people to understand who don't understand yet is a big challenge, but then those who do, you can have those conversations. I think there's ways you can, create different types of tokens or exchanges or currencies that can help even maintain the longevity of these local publishers. There's opportunities there, but I think that knowledge gap is pretty big right now. Even with all the Bitcoin news and crypto news that are happening today, that knowledge gap is still a lot. You ask the average person out there, how would you acquire Bitcoin? They probably have no idea.
I guess one thing that they could be doing is just accepting Bitcoin donations to a Bitcoin wallet. That might be a low-hanging fruit. But all right, last question for you here, Jack, is are we living in a simulation?
Gosh, that is a great question. This is a whole nother topic that I would, can spend an hour or more on. But I believe that we are in some form of a guided truth, and in the sense of in our minds, we have dreams, we have things that are happening that creates its own simulation. The reality that we're in today is a reality that our brain has processed to realize where we are and who we are. It's very, very highly likely and possible that there are multiple different versions of ourselves in the multiverse. And if that's the case, something has to be guiding that. And I believe that it's just not all by chance, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so if I could push just one step further on that, many people believe that it's likely that we could be in a simulation, but I think a lot of people think or want to think that they are the original life and that we haven't yet developed the simulation, that we're early and we're the real people. So do you have any thoughts on that aspect of whether we're eventually going to create all these simulated lives and experiences or whether we're already in it?
Yeah, I mean, you look at virtual realities, you look at the things that are being created in a virtual world. Today, we're creating those worlds. And at some point, being able to realize, have some, what do you call that? I'm missing the word right now, but being able to recognize that your own presence is there in the virtual world is something that we're building today. We are as a civilization, are pretty young compared to possible other civilizations that have been there before us, right? And that's where I believe if we're talking about, 1,000 years from now, where will our technologies be? Well, someone's already had a million year head start ahead of us, right? And maybe we are the result of that simulation that has been created. So I will never say never, but I it's very it's a great conversation to have, just to get your mind going. So
Definitely. All right. Well, Jack, thank you so much for coming on this episode. This has been great conversation, and I hope listeners go and follow your work. We didn't get to talk much about AirDeck today, but you just became the chief marketing officer there, so I'm sure that they're going to do great. They just raised another significant round of funding. So that's a very exciting project that you're working on there. Again, Jack is the CTO of Aegist. You can find that at weareaegist.com. And you're doing a lot of other things, especially with the FanZoo. So we wish you and all of those local publishers, especially, a lot of luck in 2021. Thanks for being here.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.